same thing you're doing here. Okay. All right, we're running. Well, we're interviewing Gordon McCumber, and Gordon served in the House of Representatives in the 1950s. When did you start, Gordon?
In 1955, first session.
First session in 1955, and then entered the Senate sometime in the middle 1960s, and he was president of the state Senate, I believe, in the 72?
Four, five, and seven.
Three sessions, and also served as lieutenant governor, and was active in local politics and farmers union politics as a young man. So maybe the first question could be, Gordon, tell us a little bit about your early experiences with the Farmers Union. What caused the Farmers Union to be an important force in Montana politics, and just your observations on your early involvement with it?
Well, the genesis of the Farmers Union is with the Depression and hard times. And, you know, 10,000 farmers left Montana between War One and War Two. The times were rough. It was dry and the prices weren't good. Farms were being foreclosed on. And so that's how the Farmers Union started. And they were pretty successful. They supported the weights and measures in state government. They supported the Interstate Commerce Commission, and obviously cooperatives, grain cooperatives, and retail cooperatives. And they were pretty powerful in politics.
When you say farmers union, how is the, I mean, the farm organizations would represent the viewpoint of farmers, but the Farm Bureau, is that a different concept than the farmers union?
Traditionally, the Farm Bureau, Bob, you're a Republican and I'm a Democrat, we've been friends for a long while, and we can talk about these things without getting unhappy. And there's a lot of good people in the country can do that, but some can't. But anyway, the Farm Bureau traditionally were Republicans, and the Farmers Union were Democrats. And the Farmers Union contend that the Farm Bureau was started by the Chamber of Commerce to counteract the political influence of the Farmers Union. And then there was the Grange, of course, who were pretty liberal, and I guess still are on that side, but they got burnt pretty bad with some of their first ventures, and so they decided to maintain a neutral status.
I see. But where I'm going with this is the concept of union. I mean, is there something in the way the Farmers Union is organized that makes it like a labor union? Could we understand it that way? Because a bureau sounds kind of bureaucratic, like the Farm Bureau. But they're both farmers' organizations. But was there anything in the approach that the Farmers Union had that would make it like a union? Or is that just a name?
No, I think you're right there. When I first ran for office, the labor unions and the farmers' union were the backbone of the Democratic Party. And the other party that you belong to had the corporations and the Farm Bureau and the Chamber of Commerce. They represented more employers. They were up there. They were higher income people. There's no question about that. Farmers' union had smaller farmers and lower income people, but they were friends with labor unions, and they adopted the tactics of the labor unions. So yes, there is a connection there.
And so the tactics of the labor unions would mean what? That they'd withhold grain from the market, or?
Well, they got together, and they were a democratic organization that worked collectively to achieve these goals. And one of those tactics was of course the formation of the cooperatives of working together. They really weren't in a position to withhold their services or their product from the people, or like the labor unions were. When I was a kid in Roosevelt, was then they had sit down strikes. They I guess the Supreme Court declared they couldn't strike, so they just sat down on the job. But the farmers weren't in a position to do that.
It would be difficult to organize, I suppose, to that extent, huh?
Yes.
To make that possible.
Well, they tried it. I'll give you an example. They tried it here once on potatoes. You see, the fresh vegetables were grown locally. The farmers, potato farmers, weren't getting very much for the potatoes, so they got together and formed a group, and they withheld potatoes from the market for a higher price. And so what happened is somebody come around and bought the president's entire production and for a high price, and he quit the organization, and the others were sitting there with. So they decided, they knew they had to do something on a bigger scale and have more clout and more teeth. And my father got involved in the Farmers Union and worked for them. He lobbied for the Farmers Union.
That would have been what, in the 1930s?
No, that was after he quit farming, and he had a bad back and couldn't run the dairy anymore, and he was a county chairman, and then he went to work for the president of the Farmers Union. And
the state president?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he organized a few new locals and solicited new members, and he testified on a few bills for them.
This would have been in what period?
This was about the time I got into politics, in the 50s.
Well, there was a fellow that was kind of an important president of the Farmers Union by the name of Ralph Cook.
He was vice president, yes, and the father of my friend of my father's, yes.
Why did I think? Well, I've heard of his name for some reason. I just wondered.
He was very prominent.
Okay.
Very active.
Okay. Were there other prominent active leaders in the Farmers Union that stand out in your memory?
These names will come to me. They escape me right now. You know, this has been 50 years ago.
Or more, actually, yeah.
But there were some. The president's name and the national president come here and visited and was a friend of my father's too. They were pretty powerful men.
Well, Gordon, you mentioned also that there's a relationship between cooperatives and the Farmers Union, and I know you were involved in some important legislation, territorial integrity legislation.
Yes.
And I think people who listen to this tape some years from now may not understand what that was. Maybe you could just kind of explain the need for the legislation and why you were a champion of it.
Well, the farms weren't electrified until the government got into the act. The private companies, you know, for-profit companies, provided that service to the towns. But the farmers were too far apart, and they said delivering electricity to the farms just wasn't feasible. Roosevelt got in and was looking for something to do to stimulate the economy as well as help the farmers. He started this proposal, and first the private sector was offered interest-free loans to electrify the country. They turned it down, and so the Congress then decided to let the people themselves have these interest-free loans, and the rural electric cooperatives were started. And one of the provisions the Congress stipulated was that the farmers themselves had to indicate an interest in it. And so petitions were circulated, and my father was one of the persons that circulated those petitions in Teton County. And incidentally, when it was put in, I dug post holes, dollar and a quarter a hole, and you worked your butt off to make $3 a day. So I started right in the basement of that outfit. And after I'd been in, it was a political issue after, well, there was prosperity after the war, and the farmers could pay for the electricity, and the private outfits then realized they'd missed the boat, and so they developed a war over territory.
And the idea was that as it became profitable for the investor-owned utility companies to serve rural areas, they started extending their wires and their posts out into areas that were being served by the co-ops.
Right.
And the co-ops were starting to
move into the towns.
Oh, okay, they were starting to move into the towns too?
Yeah.
Okay, well, keep going with your explanation.
So it was a ridiculous situation. It was duplication and just bad business, but they both had their pride and they were going to win, you know, and so there were several attempts made. Do you remember Bob Randall?
Yes.
He was quite a co-op man. And
he was a member of the legislature during the 60s, I think?
Yes. And then he'd come from a little 800...
Circle or someplace?
Petroleum county.
Petroleum
there were 800
county,
people
yeah.
in the county.
Winnet, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Winnet. So anyway, he was quite an REA man, and he tells of it. He got together with John Lahr, and they decided we got...
Now, John Lahr was the
lobbyist
for the Montana Power Company.
Right. And he was from Conrad. He was in my district. But so Bob tells me they decided, hey, we've got to stop this monkey business. And so a bill was drawn by the REAs, and it was introduced by Poor Deshaw. Do you remember him from
Missoula?
Right.
Republican senator from Missoula.
Right. And incidentally, this wasn't necessarily strictly along party lines, you know. So anyway, Poor's bill didn't make it, so the next year they drew up another one, and Rod Hansen, who was manager of our local REA, he was quite a wheel in the state organization, and he brought it over and got me to introduce it. So that's how I got involved in that. And that was an interesting thing. I know we've talked about who was the fellow that worked for the wool growers? Edward Shuey.
Also then became a lobbyist for Montana Power.
So I introduced this bill, and before it was printed, you know how it is when you introduce a bill and it's printed before it goes to the committee. Well, he come and asked me for a copy, and I gave it to him, and he took it right over to the House and had it introduced the exact period for period copy. That's when the shenanigans started.
Was it Representative Boots Osbornson?
I can't remember who was involved in that.
Would that have been the 1971 session?
Yes, that's right.
And I think Representative Boots Osbornson was the guy that had that bill.
And I'm sure there were some other names on my bill.
Yeah.
But anyway, the as you know, once a bill has been finally killed in one House, they no longer have to accept a bill from another House. And so their plan was to kill that bill, which would have taken care of my bill in the Senate.
And they felt they had the votes to kill that bill in the House.
Yeah.
And that would have had the effect then of killing your bill, because it was the same bill.
But they fouled up and they put it on the table. And John Lahr thought it was dead. But as you know, you can get a bill off the table with a two-thirds vote. So he came over and told me, now, Gordon, he said, next year we'll get together with a good bill. And I said, this one isn't dead. Oh, sure it is, he said. And I said, no, it's just on the table. And that's the fastest I've ever seen John Lahr move. But anyway, and then, you know, Ed Smith got in on the act, and he was a Republican.
Ed Smith was a Republican representative from up in the northeastern part of the state.
Yeah, from Dagmar, I think.
Yeah.
But he was an REA supporter, as I recall.
Right.
And so anyway, we were maneuvering back and forth, and we were concerned about Jim Lucas, who was Speaker of the House, but he was considering running for governor, I believe, at that time. At any rate, Ed got him, he talked to him, and finally, one day, we got up in a little committee room behind on the north side of the gallery of the House, and got together and cut a deal. And I remember Ed Smith saying, if anybody changes one period on this, it's dead. But, and I know the other side didn't like it, but we got her through anyway.
Okay.
And you were a freshman.
I was a freshman when that happened,
And you know, I asked Rod the other day how it worked, and he said, good. Once we got over the hostility and decided we had to get along together, they did. They laid out the air of the territory, and they there was some controversy over the size of the capacity of a line. But for an example, I have a sprinkler on my farm out west here. It's on the Montana power line that goes to Augusta. Well, it's up against that line, so I have one sprinkler on the Montana power line. That's their territory, and the other one's on the REA line. That's their territory.
You know, Gordon, my recollection of that legislation in the House was that there was one really close vote on the House floor on an amendment that Ed Smith made on the floor of the House in the 1971 session. And there was some dramatic telephone or a picture taken of the voting board. Do you remember anything about that?
I know that the statutes and maybe the Constitution didn't allow for recording a vote on second reading.
Yeah. And some folks thought, well, it'd be pretty informative for the people to see who voted for and against that particular amendment. It was an amendment of Ed Smith on the bill we're talking about, and it prevailed, as I recall, by one vote. And so someone took a picture of the voting board and managed to escape from the Capitol building, and the result of that photograph was published. But that was those were exciting times in the history of Montana. And of course, the Montana Power Company was a pretty major player in state politics. Do you remember lobbyists from the Montana Power Company? Do you have any thoughts or impressions of how they operated?
They used to talk about the old copper collar.
Yes.
And you see, there were, at least you say, there were the Democrats and the Republicans and the Montana Power Company. And if the Montana Power Company could control a few swing votes, they could get things done their way. They were a pretty powerful lobby. And they go back to the War of the Copper Kings, you know, and then it's my understanding that the Anaconda Company made the Montana Power Company to provide the electricity for the Anaconda.
Yes, yeah. I believe that's correct. Yeah, so you generally associated them with each other in the politics of the state, is that right?
Yeah. I remember Ted Swindon once making a speech about a cowboy hat on my old Capitol Dome up there, the Copper Dome of the Capitol. But yeah, they were very powerful, very influential.
And did they pursue a particular strategy?
I think they also owned most of the daily newspapers in the state, didn't they?
The Anaconda Company did, yeah.
Yeah, all but Great Falls, I think, maybe.
Now, in the legislature, do you remember a fellow by the name of Denny Shea or Billy Ray?
I remember there was a, in the Senate, there was a Shea from Butte. He was mayor. He used to give me a...
Jimmy Shea.
Jimmy. He was a different Shea.
Yeah.
No, this one must have been before my time, Bob.
Al Wilkinson?
No, he was before my time, too.
Lloyd Crippen?
Crippen, I remember, yeah. And then there were the two Corrett brothers.
Yes.
Weren't there two of them?
Bob and Jack Corrett.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they hired Shuey, and then John Lahr, who had been a good Farmers Union member before he hired him. Well, he was a good cooperative man anyway.
Yeah.
His father-in-law was Congressman Leroy Anderson.
Did you know Leroy Anderson?
Yes. We ran together. We served together in the Senate. When at one of these reapportionment schemes, we ended up with four counties and two senators at large, so yes, we served together.
What do you remember about him? He, of course, was a congressman at one time and a general, as I recall. During
he was a general. He was a general in the reserve or the guard. I don't know what he could have been, but I.
Uh-huh.
Well, I knew him well, and we campaigned together. And I visited him at his house, and he came to my home. And he got involved in a process up there to make something out of barley, and he was a chemical engineer, and it didn't work out, and it was too bad. But he was pretty good fellow, quite outspoken.
Now, when we talk about the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company, one of the things that preceded me in the legislature, but I know was a part of the process when you were there in the 50s and 60s, were hospitality suites. And I understand the Anaconda Company had one, and there may have been several, you know, at different times. Trading Stamps apparently had one. The Railroad Association may have had one. The petroleum people may have had one at one time or another. But the one I think that was best known was the Anaconda Company hospitality suite or watering.
The Placer Hotel.
The Placer Hotel. Any thoughts or recollections about that?
They had birthday parties every night, and they transferred people's birthday up to the months during the session. And, of course, the Democrats pretty much stayed away from that, but... One night, some of us decided to go up just for the heck of it, and I got up there, and there was a bunch of Republicans from Teton County up and went back home, and it got mentioned in the next election. But it was quite a place. They had a hind quarter of beef up there, and hams, and all the booze you wanted. And, you know, in those days, we got $10 a day, expenses and salary. And there were some people that would have gone hungry, I think, if it hadn't have been for those places. Especially if they drank a little, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And a cheap motel room was $6. That left you $4 a day left to live on there and pay the rent back home. Yeah, they were good at it. When I went there, they come up and shook my hand, how are you? When my wife had a birthday, they'd come around and remind me. But they never bothered me. They never tried to, I got into it. They faced off against me once in my position on you remember the silicosis issue?
A little bit, yeah.
The silicosis is a industrial disease caused by silica dust, and it gets in the lungs, you know. And it was such an issue that they built that lung hospital at Galen to take care of those people and TB patients.
There was some controversy, wasn't there, about whether the Anaconda Company should have taken more of the responsibility for paying for those silicotic benefits?
Yeah. They used those air drills, and they called them widowmakers.
Yeah.
And then the state took care of them when they could no longer work and buried them when they died, see. So anyway, about the time I come along, they got this bill in to make them responsible for it. And they one of the lobbyists come in and said, you know, you farmers have got just as much trouble out there with the elevators, and he insisted, to be fair, that we put the elevators in there, which was baloney. But anyway, it was one of those things you do to get it through. And it passed, and then the Montana Power Company came out to Shoto and put on a big show and said, your representative McComber has forced this on you farmers. But I was armed with a list of the cost per county for that disease, and Teton County shared, and someone in the government had put this list together in all the counties. There was the one in Teton County, and of course nobody had silicosis.
So what you're saying is the people in the state of Montana had to pay for these
benefits. They did.
But there was no silicotic. There was no guy with silicosis
right.
in Teton County.
That's right.
So you were able to point out to your constituents here
yeah.
that in fairness, somebody else
yeah.
should be paying for this burden. Yeah. Perhaps the
they did. They put in wet drills and air conditioning, and it worked.
And it made a difference.
Yeah.
Sure.
Of course the underground mines were on their way out there anyway, but it worked. Could I just, one thing, you mentioned these stamps, trading stamps.
Yeah.
I got more letters on that damn trading stamp bill. Those women were either for it or against it, and they all knew why, and they inundated the Capitol with letters.
Now explain what trading stamps were.
Well, this first guy was pretty smart. He comes to town, and he sets up a trading stamp program with a grocery store. He sells them the stamps, and he provides them with the stamps. And the people that bought there got stamps, which they could cash in for premiums.
So you buy $10 worth of groceries, and you get a certain number of stamps
right.
for the amount of groceries you buy. And then you paste them in a little book, and when you get a book full, that entitles you to, what?
Yeah.
A credit on your next grocery bill?
Yes, right. But the problem was, Green Stamps did it first, and he got all the business in town. And here comes along Gold Stamps and gets his competitor. So they're both paying into this, and they're still dividing up the business in town. And so the merchants themselves, they had to do it to compete, but they got the bill in there to eliminate it. But the women...
The merchants themselves didn't like the trading stamps.
No. As long as only one in town had it, it was fine. But when they all had to do it, it was just a ripoff.
I see.
The women come in there madder than hell. That's the only money that's the only money I've got that belongs to me. My husband won't give me any more. Leave them like they are. She wanted them.
They wanted the trading
stamps.
Yeah,
some of them did.
Because they could have a little nest egg of
yep.
those trading stamps that had some value that they themselves controlled. Huh?
But boy, I had to get the letters on that, both sides.
Did they, what eventually happened?
Oh, it took care of it. I think so, or it died out, the merchants just got together.
They don't exist anymore. I remember them when
no.
I was a kid, but they don't exist
no.
anymore that I know of.
That was one of those fun things.
Now, is there a particular legislator or legislators maybe that kind of stand out in your mind, maybe two or three? Gosh, you served in the House and Senate probably a couple of decades or more total.
Yeah, 21 or 2 years anyway. There were some pretty good people there. There were a lot of good people. And in Montana, in these rural counties, you're only one person away from... everybody in the county, you know, everybody knows somebody that knows you, see. So you can't get away with much out here, and if you want to. But the rural counties especially, I think we're pretty good at sending responsible people over there. And, of course, we had our political positions, but hell, out of 1,000 bills, you had 10 or 15 of those, and the rest of them you just got together and worked for the state of Montana.
Sure.
Leo Graybolt Sr. was... Speaker of the House in my first term.
That would have been in 55.
Yes, yeah. And he was really an outstanding man. And I think, of course, of Bill Groff and...
Senator Bill Groff
yes,
from the Valley County,
right.
Democrat.
And Senator Manning was a powerful
Senator
man.
Senator Dave Manning
yes,
from Treasure County,
yeah,
also
should,
a Democrat.
Yeah.
There for many, many years, of course.
Yeah, he was. And he got so old he could hardly, you know, but they liked him over there, and they sent him. And of course, there's Francis, of course. Everyone knows Francis.
Representing Francis Bardineau from
yes.
Harlem, who was a Democrat, member of the chairman of the House Appropriations
yes.
Committee.
He was a man that understood government, and most of us went over there a little timid and shy to learn the ropes. 2 weeks, old Francis, nobody was telling him anything. He knew how the system worked, and he was working it.
Now, Francis Bardineau had a speech impediment.
Yes, he did. He had cleft
palate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember when he first come, they stared at him, and he got up to give a speech, and they quit staring at him. They started listening. He was a very brilliant, very just had a wonderful mind. You know, he was a little spoiled, as a matter of fact. He threw temper tantrums, but he liked to get his way. But he was very persuasive, and he had a. Did you meet his wife ever?
Venus, I think, or Venice.
Yeah. And she was great for little kids in the downtrodden, and that old Francis was pretty liberal. Yeah, he knew how to use the power of government. I'd been vice chairman of appropriations until Wernon, I think it was. I'd been vice chairman under Lloyd. Wernon was a speaker.
Ray Warrenin was a representative from Butte,
yes.
Was Speaker of the House of Representatives,
yes.
In 1965.
Yeah, and he appointed Francis chairman of appropriations. So Francis decides we got to visit all the institutions and universities. So he goes and commandeers a state guard plane, two of them, DC-3s, and they flew us all over the state. We got snowed in at Miles City. But anyway, they used to do that, but then the federal government put a stop to that. They said that wasn't the Air Guard business, but that we used to fly around in those planes. But Francis took us to all the universities and all the institutions. And we used to go with the highway patrolmen, and we still went in state planes after that.
Now, Bardineau's first session, I think, was 1959.
He was two after me, yes.
Were you there in 59?
Yes, I was there two ahead in 55, 57, and 59.
Do you remember there was a particularly controversial piece of legislation that was introduced by a fellow from up in my part of the state that Representative Dale McGarvey told me about it, an interview that I conducted last week, and it was introduced by a representative by the name of Cy Tonner from
Cy
Clyde
Tonner.
County. And it had to do with some kind of a public utility district. Some
PUD.
Kind of, well, tell us about that.
Well,
because I think that was a major political issue, wasn't it?
It was. You see, PUDs are like our, in Washington, I believe, public utility districts. And the cities formed their own cooperatives, and they called them public utility districts. And they're like our cooperative. They just got started with that. So, yes, Cy was a fellow with one eye, and boy, he had an opinion. And he started that, and it was just as controversial as the REAs. But you see, this would have allowed the cities and towns to form a P. I'm not sure, but I think it might even put them in a position to buy out the private outfit. But those PUDs are still working over there, some of those large
cities. In Washington
State. Yeah.
So the legislation was introduced by Tonner, and apparently it was defeated in the House.
I don't remember, Bob. It probably was. It never passed. We don't have that law.
Yeah. But then it was an issue in the 1960 election. According to Dale McGarvey, he said it was a pretty hot issue in the 1960 election. At least it was up in the Flathead.
It could have been. Did Dale happen to mention to you Paradise Dam?
Nope.
You remember Paradise Dam?
No, I don't.
It was a hell of a big deal up there, and it was going to be a dam on the Paradise River, and I was chairman of the irrigation committee, and we had a speaker named, wasn't it, Gene Mahoney from up in Sanders County?
Gene Mahoney was a representative and a senator from Sanders County.
Well, he was Speaker of the House once.
It must have been about 57.
We went back in those. But anyway, they had this hearing, and the railroad was against it because it would have moved the railroad, and boy, it got hot. The Farmers Union was in it, and the private utilities, and the railroad, and they hired these buses and hauled people down there, and they said it was the biggest crowd that had ever been in the House chambers. And someone hired Wellington D. Rankin, and I remember when he come in, and when everything quieted down, he was quite a... We'll get back to this lobbyist, but
yeah.
He did that. He did that. But anyway, something happened.
So he spoke persuasively, Rankin did?
Oh, yes. Yes. The son of a gun, what he did, he had a list of people he represented, and there were two labor unions. And I thought, what's going on here? So after the hearing was over, and I'd adjourned it, and he came up and he gave me a piece of paper, and he said, say I made a mistake. I don't represent these two unions. But it had already been in the paper, and the unions were madder than hell at him, and they sent in a rebuttal, but nobody read that. You know? So anyway, I'll tell you, Libby Dam was coming into the field at they were thinking about it then. And so I had this bill in the committee. I still got it. Just died there. I used to do that, you know, just died in committee. But Rankin was quite a lobbyist. And Glenn, somebody else from the Montana Power Company, were around there. They were
Glenn Kearney.
No, this is a big guy. He was I'll tell you, he was a very professional lobbyist, but he wasn't too well loved, and I think Leo Graybill Sr. kicked him out of his office when he was president of the Constitution Revision. He was very effective, and another legislator.
Who was he a lobbyist for?
He was a freelance lobbyist. He actually lobbied for the dairymen, and sometimes. Hmm. And of course, the governors.
You said another legislator crossed your mind?
Kind of. I guess those were the outstanding ones. Gene Turnage was he was president of the Senate like we were too. Yeah. He was really an outstanding legislator.
What do you remember about Turnage?
Very well respected.
Republican from Lake County and later Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And president of the Senate after I was. He was Republican floor leader during one of my sessions. Very well respected and thought of, and very persuasive, very, very articulate. He and Bill Groff, things were dragging over there, you know, so they just went to Hawaii for a week during the session. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah, I do.
And they got away with it.
It's kind of a funny story. The way I think Turnage explained it to me was that they had thought that the session would be over at about when they made reservations to go to Hawaii. And so they got to the point where, you know, they couldn't cancel the reservations, and it became clearer and clearer that looked like the session was going to last a little longer than they planned. So they just thought, what the heck, we're going to go anyway. So they did, and Turnage told me a funny story too. He said that Bill Groff and his wife, and Gene Turnage and his wife, were both in Hawaii, and the news story got out, and of course Gene is spelled, it's the French spelling of Gene, it's not like Eugene, G-E-N-E, it's J-E-A-N, like Jean, you know, the French spelling of Gene. So anyway, the story was in the newspaper, and apparently Bill Groff got an angry letter from one of his constituents saying it was bad enough that you went to Hawaii before the legislative session ended, but it was just such a horribly dishonorable thing to go traipsing off with that awful Gene Turnage when he was supposedly happily married.
Were you ever on appropriations?
No.
That Groff, and you know, and Nichols.
Representative Norris Nichols, also from Ravalli County and a Republican.
Yes, but you know, Norris finally told me that it was Groff's dad that got him to run and gave him the money to get in there.
Really?
Yes. Huh. But anyway, Groff was...
And they were from the same county, and Groff a Democrat and Nichols a Republican.
And Groff was chairman of Ways and Means in the Senate, which is appropriations in the House, and Nichols was in the House, so that Ravalli County ran the...
They called him the Gold Dust Twins. Now, Gordon, you mentioned you had a friendship with Gene Turnage and great respect for him, and we've discussed how there was this friendship, this bond between Norris Nichols and Bill Groff. It sounds as though perhaps in a lot of your experience in state politics, there wasn't as great a gulf between Democrats and Republicans perhaps as there is now, or maybe it was greater in the 50s and less in the 70s, or do you have any thoughts or observations about that?
Well, yes, I do, and this goes back to the Farmers Union. The Farmers Union was a dominant force in Teton County politics, and they could win in the primary. But some of the people didn't like the Farmers Union, so they'd defeat their candidate in the general election. And that's how I got involved, really. As I said, the party faithful got together and decided they were going to have to get the younger generation involved. And they kind of bypassed those old hardliners and got some more middle-of-the-roaders that realized they had to reach out and get somebody that had something else going for them. And so I got the Farmers Union vote, obviously. My father was at that time a lobbyist for them, but I got these other votes that the other candidates hadn't managed to get. So after, because I'd been a veteran amongst other things, so after
you're a World War II veteran.
Yes, and so after a while, I was defeated, and it come to me.
When were you defeated?
Well, I had three sessions, and I think I was defeated in the fourth.
1960.
61 maybe.
Election of 1960.
So it became very clear to me I could represent the people of Teton County and get elected, or represent the Farmers Union and stay home. And so I made a decision. But I still had most of them. The only opposition I had were the extremists on both ends of the spectrum. So I got along very good. I got along with Norris. I tell you, I was having lunch with Norris over there once, and here comes some my constituents from up north. We sat down there and visited and had lunch, and they come up to visit the Capitol after lunch, and he come over to me and he said, "See, what's that Nichols doing sitting over there on the Republican side?" Yeah, I got along. I had a working relationship.
Well, I remember that distinctly about you, because my first session in the Senate, you were the president of the Senate. In fact, you were. What did you say from 72 to 76? Is that
no 74? That's first special session after we had one annual session after the Constitution.
So 74.
Yeah. And then
I didn't arrive there until the 75 session. You were president of the Senate in 75, and then again in 77.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right.
So you probably served president of the Senate longer than anybody ever.
I think I'm the only one that made three.
That made three, yeah.
Yeah. Now with his restrictions on that,
with term limitations, that's a record that's never going to be equaled until that's.
Well, I made up my mind. I'm going to be neutral. No friends, no enemies. Doesn't make any difference between Democrats and Republicans, and it worked out.
Yeah, that was your reputation. There was no question about that.
When I first started, you remember Pat Gilfeather?
I do. A senator from Great Falls,
yeah.
Democrat senator from Great Falls.
He was a Farmers Union guy. And
also an attorney, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he was going to help me out a little about the first week, and I called time on him, and he said, "I'm not done yet." And I said, "You're dumb." And then...
He was pretty assertive, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was really... well thought of the Farmers Union. He thought he was quite a wheel over here. Next thing that happened to me was Margaret Warden.
Yes.
She was very strong in the library business, and her husband was publisher of the Tribune.
Of the Great Falls Tribune. Senator Margaret Warden, Democrat from Great Falls.
Just died here recently.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. Anyway, she was giving a spiel there, and I called time on her, and she wanted a little time more, and I said, "No, thank you. Sorry." And she started to cry. And Jimmy Shea got up and said, "Mr. President, you made her cry. Aren't you ashamed of yourself?" And then there was a young attorney from Billings got up and took me on. And Earl Mortz was a Republican.
Republican senator from Lewistown.
We served on the Appropriations Committee on institutions for years together, and he got up and told that young gentleman what was what. So after that, I never had any trouble with anyone.
I remember a funny story about you. Senator Neil Lynch,
yeah,
Democrat from Butte, was the majority floor leader.
Yeah.
One of the sessions that you were president of the Senate, and he was interested in something I believe was called transcendental meditation.
Yes, he was.
And it was a wonderful thing for him, good therapy for him and that sort of thing. And so there was some fella that knew a lot about this that was in Helena and was going to put on some kind of a public demonstration and explain to people who were interested in it all about it that evening at the Colonial. So Neil stood up on the floor when you were in the rostrum, and he explained, you know, about this and how it had been a wonderful thing for him and how it had just rejuvenated him mentally and how he hoped other people might be interested in taking advantage of it too. And he said something to the effect that what you do is you just get everything out of your mind. You just concentrate on nothing, and if you do that with a clear mind, it is the most wonderfully restful thing that can happen to you. And there was a little silence after he said that, and you were up in the rostrum and you said, "Well, Neil, on the farm we call that a nap." Do you remember that?
No.
Everybody chuckled.
You know, I did that. I those things come out of me. Did you know Senator Hafferman? Did we talk about
Bill Hafferman, Democrat from Libby?
Yeah. And he would talk like a preacher. He'd get up there and wave his arms and carry on. And
he had that black suit coat,
yes,
and that black bow tie, and he used great big $4 words and waved his arms.
So he was going on up there one day, and I sat in the row in front of him, and he paused a bit, and I said, "Amen." And I was out of order, you know. And they kind of enjoyed hearing it. First, he was going to be mad at me, and then he decided, no, it was all right. It got him a good friendly laugh. So.
Do you remember Senator Ben Stein?
Yes, I remember Ben Stein.
Anything about him?
Was it Ben Stein? He was a kind of a soft, slow-talking... Let's see, where did he come from? Oh, he was the guy that took on the highway department? Yes, I remember him.
I think he was elected because of some highway dispute down in Park County, and he came in as a Democrat, and then he switched parties and was a Republican, and he was kind of getting mad at the Republicans and thinking about becoming an independent about the time he left. But I remember him as a very independent-minded...
He spent that ranch fighting the highway department.
Is that right? Yeah.
Do you know how he come out here as a young guy to work? And he was working on this ranch, and it's a hired hand, a hayhand, you know, and the boss was trying to sell it, and he had this buyer, potential buyer, they were talking, and they were arguing, and Ben said, would you really take that much for it? And the guy says, yes. Ben says, I'll take it. He came from a wealthy family.
Yeah, he came from a wealthy family back east. He was also an author.
Got his book.
You got his book?
About that.
A Rough Trip Through Paradise,
yeah,
or something
about that,
like that. Andrew Garcia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that too, and it's a real interesting book.
Yeah.
I think he found some old papers someplace, and
yeah,
he was able to kind of put him into the form of a book. He was well educated from some Ivy League school, kind of an interesting sort of a guy. Do you remember any other Butte legislators that stand out in your mind? We talked about Wernon and Lynch and so on. They're interesting part of Montana.
Were you there when we used to have the bomb threats?
No, I don't remember
that. And after about three of them, I got together with the attorney generals and the leadership on both sides, and we decided we just couldn't shut the Senate down because we'd clear the whole damn Capitol, and then the city police would come in and go through everything, you know.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back into session, and I had to call down to Jorgensen's to get those Butte guys to come back up so we'd have enough people to do business.
Because the minute there was a bomb threat, they'd all race down to the bar. And then they didn't want to come back again. Was there any suspicion that they might have had something to do with it?
I don't know. But Annie, you know Tommy Tao.
Representative and Senator Tom Tao, Democrat from Billings.
Yeah. He operated like a congressman. He used more paper than... The girls used to come up and complain to me that he's on his third or fourth order of paper, you know. But anyway, I'm sitting up there once, and, you know, when the president, during the vote, the president, or during second reading, the president goes back to his seat on the aisle. So I'm sitting back there once, and the vote's coming out on second reading, and I look, the whole damn front row is empty, but we're getting more votes, and we've got people. And those guys were down there, and they had one fella back and running up and down that row of seats, voting for everybody.
Voting for everybody else. Boy, they could have been in big trouble for that.
Yeah, one guy had his son voting for him.
I remember that. I think he had a little boy sitting on his lap, or
yeah,
maybe he went out in the cloakroom and he just had his little 6-year-old son sitting there.
Yeah. Luke McEwen was a very effective speaker, persuasive speaker.
Public speaker. Luke McEwen was a Democrat senator and a lawyer from Anaconda.
Didn't he get in some kind of trouble with that workman's comp?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh, I think so.
Yeah.
How was he? You say he was persuasive as a public
speaker?
Yeah.
He'd stand up there and lean on that desk, and he just swayed the bolt. He was very, very persuasive. He was good.
Do you remember, now you served with several governors, and one of them you served in the Senate with, Stan Stevens, who later went on and became governor?
Yes.
And then, of course, you started out in legislative service under Governor Aronson?
Yes.
And you served under Governor Nutter, I believe. Maybe not. Maybe you missed him because you were out that 61 session.
I served with Nutter.
But you served with Nutter in the legislature.
Yes,
right?
We were on the same appropriation committee together.
And then also with Governor Babcock, and then you were president of the Senate under Governor Judge, and then you were lieutenant governor under Governor Schwinnen. So you've got some wonderful perspective about governors. Maybe you could comment a little bit about the governors that you knew and served with.
Well, Hugo was I liked him. They called him the Galloping Swede, and he was a great, big, good-natured guy, you know. And the joke he told on himself was when he come in, he was roused about for the oil rigs, you know. And they had 16-foot planks that were soaking wet, and he was getting up a good sweat moving these planks, and somebody said to him, take five, Hugo, and he said, I can hardly lift one. Yeah, and his little daughter, Tricia was her name?
Rika.
She ran around there. She was a cute little gal.
Yeah.
And I got along with him all right. We used to take the school kids up there, and he gave me some good advice once to the kids. He said, a governor or any executive can't do it himself. He's judged. His success depends upon his ability to appoint the right people in administrative positions. And that was good. He was kind of a rough guy, and I think some of those Polish fellows thought they could have done a little better for him. But he was all right. Yeah. And then who come next?
Then Aronson was followed by Nutter.
Nutter. And he was killed in that plane crash out here.
But you said you served with him?
Yes. I like the governor that's governor that's boss. Nutter was. I didn't agree with his political philosophy, of course, but at least he was in control there. He straightened out the highway department a little, and he was getting into the fishing game. And yeah, I had to be on appropriation committee when he was governor. I think.
And did he exhibit a strong personality when he was the appropriations committee with you?
Yes.
He was decisive, apparently, and.
I thought so. Uh-huh. I had a little other connection with him. My school friend, I went to high school with Johnny McInerney, was his co-pilot. And they flew together, and Johnny got, he got on another plane, and they, one plane ran into another, and three of them went down. So anyway, his family here is good friends of the Nutters, and I went to his
This was during World War II that this incident? I see, okay. And so Nutter was a flyer during World War II?
Yeah, he was a B-24 pilot.
I see.
Yeah. He had a story once. He told me about over there they practiced shooting with shotguns a lot, you know, the aerial gunners did. And they accidentally hit an Arab woman. Or a Native woman. Yeah, I guess it was an Arab. And so to make things right, the commanding officer went up and gave her some money. And next day there was a half a dozen guys down there with their wives.
All claiming that they had some buckshot in them, huh?
Yeah, and let's see, Babcock. Yeah, I served with Babcock in the House.
You would have served with Babcock in the House?
Yeah, he got the job after Nutter, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember too much about him. And then come...
Well, you served in the legislature with him, and then he also served in the Senate, I think, when he was governor, didn't you?
I think I was still in the House, maybe, when he was...
Well, you were... When were you in the House? You were in the House in 55, 57, and 59, and then you were out 61...
Yeah,
when did you come back into the House?
Just out one session.
So you came back in the House in 63 and 65?
60.
And then when did you go into the Senate? 67?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I guess I was probably there. Yeah. He flew, and I used to fly, and I went on a few trips with him on the state plane, and he'd fly sometime, and I'd fly the plane sometime, never landed it. So yeah, I remember him, and Betty was a fine lady. I always liked her.
How would you describe you mentioned that your political philosophy was different than Nutter, and I assume probably different than Babcock. How would you describe that difference?
Just get out the party platforms, Bob, and look at both of them. You know, there was this thing about cooperatives, taxing cooperatives, and regulation and that sort of thing, which is, some people think certain amount of regulation is necessary, and some of them don't want to have it at all. But I served with those people, and when the political vote come up, we'd go back and vote on it, and then go back in a room to our business, you know, and finish it out. It's kind of hard for some newcomers to understand that honest politicians can actually do that, you know. Some people think there's gods on one side and the devil on the other, and there's no in between.
You know, maybe a sort of a God and a devil issue when you were there in the 1960s. It surfaced then, and it's flickered on and off again for most of the Montana history that I've been involved in politics. The sales tax.
Oh, yeah. That was a basic difference.
Well, explain that. Explain how that's a basic difference.
Very simple. The sales tax was on the lower income people, and the income tax and the corporation tax was on the upper income people. Money is the big issue, you know. Some of these moral issues are just used to justify their position. That was the big, always.
You know, it's interesting, though, Gordon, because I think that Montana's political history on that particular issue has been different than most other states. As I understand it, most of the sales taxes went into effect in the 30s, during the Depression, when the governments of the states were really, really stressed. And in many cases, maybe even in all cases, they were enacted by Democrat legislators and Democrat governors. Somehow or other in Montana, they were interested, I think, basically in sustaining government and, you know, getting a greater source of government to fund government programs. I think that's the reason sales taxes went into effect in the other states. But in Montana, that history wasn't followed. Here, the feeling was that the sales tax was a tax on the poor people to help the rich people. And any thoughts on that? I mean, you've already articulated.
You read Joseph Kinsey Howard.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard about a Russian Jew named Levine?
Yeah, he was a professor at the University of Montana.
Yeah, and the chancellor of
Louis Levine.
Yeah, and the chancellor over there was concerned. He used to call, you don't have a chancellor anymore.
No.
He was concerned about the falling income for the university system.
This would have been the late 19-teens, early 1920s, something
around
like that.
Around the Depression time there, anyway.
Okay.
And so he, Levine was a professor there, I believe. And so the chancellor asked Levine to do a study on the mining of taxation on mines. And he did it. And then the mud hit the fan. So the chancellor fired him. And then they put the pressure on him. He had to hire him back.
Now, the reason Levine was the reason that was controversial is because his study showed that the mining companies weren't paying taxes.
Right. And they had a heck of a
and I think that, I think it was something like the farmers in Montana, if I remember the story, accounted for a high percentage of the population, but a combined rather small percentage of mm-hmm. the earned income, whereas the mines accounted for a greater percentage of the income, but they paid a lot less of the tax than the farmers did. Something like that. Wasn't that the bottom line of the study?
Who was this last writer? Toole. The writer Toole.
Ross Toole?
Yeah.
Well, another historian.
Yeah, he quotes Howard, and I just had Hom's fresh on this. I just looked at it last night. And he had this chart you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they gerrymandered the towns on taking property that was going to be taxed out of the city, you know.
Yeah.
And there were all these things put together. I think it goes back to those old bitter old labor fights with the company and labor, where they saw they were going to be taxed and the corporation
so
wasn't.
So what you're saying is that there was a greater, that tax equity was perhaps a greater issue in Montana historically than it may have been in some of these other states, where they just looked there at a sales tax as another way of getting revenue. In our state, that when we talked about a tax, because of the Levine experience and the fact that we had mining companies that perhaps weren't paying their fair share of taxes, the thought came up whenever we talked about taxes, about the fairness of taxes. At least maybe that was a bigger issue in Montana. Is that where you're?
I don't know. Bob, I don't know about those other states, but I know this. It's always been perceived as an income tax is a tax on the little guy, and I think if they correspondingly increase the corporation tax, we used to call it a corporation license tax.
Right.
Do they
right.
still call it
yes,
that?
Yes. Uh-huh.
They do it, and it was a license.
But it's just a corporate income tax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a license, in effect, to do business in
right.
Montana. And I think the Democrats regard those companies not as benevolent organizations putting money into Montana, but as private profit organizations who are here to take the money out for Eastern investors.
So a Republican might look at a big corporation as a source of jobs in the state. You said putting money in.
Yes.
And a Democrat, to help us understand the difference here, might look at a big corporation as something primarily interested in making money for itself and perhaps even taking it out of the state. Is
right, and the money they spent here and the taxes they spent obviously cut down on the profits, so that was kind of incidental. But their main object was to make money. You know, that's all right. They were there. They're not regarded by the Democrats as benevolent organizations. They're extractive industries. Well, and another thing, when I first got in there, you know, and the teachers weren't getting the damn thing, and so the Democrats got their pay up there, and somebody said we're going to raise their pay till they switch parties and become Republicans, which they did. You know, they turned their back on poor old Blaylock, and he was the best friend education ever had.
Yeah, that was when Chet Blaylock ran for governor, I think, in 1992, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you also knew Governor Judge?
Yes, I was in the House with him, too. We were together in the House. He was a good governor. He was a Kennedy kid. You know, he was in my opinion, he was a man of the times. He come in when that big change swept the nation and hired a bunch of young guys and women. And my wife was his executive secretary, you know.
Jean Handel.
Yes, and she was executive secretary to Forrest Anderson, too. And when
I'd forgotten to ask you about him, but go ahead, keep talking about Governor Judge until you're.
I liked him. He was a good.
And you also served in the legislature with him. Any recollections of him as a legislator?
Well, yeah, he was quite. He talked well. He made a good presentation, of course. And little side story on that: he was a lobbyist before he was in the legislature for, I think it was the Hamilton family or one of those families that have the concessions in Yellowstone Park, and he worked for them and got bills through for them. And so when I was president of the Senate, President Ford come back to Montana, and he'd been a ranger at Yellowstone. So this is in the summertime, and Governor Judge went to see him, and he wanted somebody to go along that had a little title, I guess. And so I was president of the Senate then. So he invited me along. We went out and met Ford.
Wow.
And we went to West Yellowstone, and he cleared me with the Secret Service to go up to the plane and meet Ford, but they wouldn't let me go. So Ford comes back then, they shook hands with all the people around there. But anyway, then we went out to Old Faithful, and I saw him out there again. And so I was kind of in a hot spot on that. You see, it was Governor Judge that appointed me to run the Department of Agriculture. I resigned from the Senate to run when he appointed me to run the Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
George Lackman had retired.
I think I do remember that now, yeah.
And
that was about 1977?
Yeah, it was after. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And so my wife was his executive secretary, Judge's. So, and Swindon was lieutenant governor. So Swindon and I had been together in the House, and he used to kid him, saying, "When you run for governor, I'll vote for you." So he runs against Judge.
And your judge had appointed you Secretary of Agriculture.
Yes, my wife's working for him.
And your wife's working for him, but you'd already told Swindon, probably seriously, too.
Oh, it did, yeah.
Yeah.
So things got a little hairy around there.
What happened? Did you stick with your commitment to Swindon?
Oh, as soon as Swindon announced, I called up and got an appointment with Tom and told him, "Hey, this is the way it is." I said, "I'll resign." "No, I can't have you do that." You know, and which he couldn't, it would have looked bad. So I said, "Well, I'll finish out the term, and I won't, during the primary, I won't get involved and say anything." So that's the way it was.
And was he angry, or was he disappointed, or was he?
No. Well, the interesting thing is that Jean, my wife, got a commitment from him to reappoint me even if Swindon lost. So, but no, it was kind of nebulous there for a while, but it come out all right. Jean was such a friend of his that we saw a lot of each other afterwards. We had dinner together.
Well, Governor Judge.
Yes.
Afterwards, even.
And of course, Swindon was a very decisive man. I liked his style.
Did you continue as the director of the Department of Agriculture under Swindon then?
No. Let's see. Yes. Oh, yes. He reappointed me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leo Berry and I are the only two he reappointed to the whole cabinet.
And Dave Lewis, wasn't he also? I don't know.
He had worked for Judge, but I don't think he had that position.
At the cabinet level.
Under Judge. Because he didn't. Swindon never reappointed anyone but Leo Berry.
Well, I know Dave was both in the Judge administration
and
the Swindon administration.
Yes, he was. Very smart guy, brilliant guy.
Smart guy. And so then, but do you remember Swindon from being in the legislature with
him? Oh, yes.
Well, describe him as a legislator.
Well, he from the first, it was apparent that he was a comer. He was smart, he had intelligence, and he got along with people, and it just stuck out all over him that he was an up-and-coming guy. So I think from the beginning, I felt that about him. And then he was appointed by Forrest Anderson to run state lands. And I worked with him on that a little, and then Senator Bollinger got up a bill to study saline seep.
Now, Senator Gordon Bollinger was from Glasgow.
Yes.
And he was a Democrat.
Yes.
Okay.
And so a statewide organization was formed that pretty well financed, too, to study saline seep, and we didn't know where to put it. You know, all these things got to be under somebody. So Swindon called me one day down there, and he said, "Why don't you give it to me?" So we gave it to him. But I was appointed chairman of that statewide organization.
That would have been in about the 59 session or something?
No, it was after I was in the Senate this come up.
So Schwinnen was the director of the Department of State Lands.
Yes, when he was... Yeah, he was State Lands then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
He'd served a couple of terms in the House of Representatives from up in the northeastern part
of
the state.
From the
late 50s, I think. And then Governor Anderson appointed him to his cabinet as the director of Department of State Lands sometime in the late 60s. What are your impressions of Anderson?
He was a good governor. Boy, he was the boss. No monkey business about him. I'll tell you, I heard a couple of stories about him, and I don't know. Anyway, he had got Tom Judge to run with him as lieutenant governor. And the story goes that after the election, he said, "Now, Tommy, goodbye. I don't want to see you no more." He was the governor.
Yeah. Huh.
And I know my predecessor, George Lackman, was appointed. He was a director of agriculture. And Forrest had the Indian sign on him. He just so George told me once it was a really important decision to make, and it was kind of political, so he thought he better talk to the governor. So he goes up to see Forrest and told him about it, and Forrest said, "I hired you to make that decision, and you make the right one or I'll fire you."
But he didn't tell him what he thought the right one was, huh?
No, he was... I was on a fund study once when... No, under him, I guess. And I got to meet him a little bit. He was the governor, no question about it. Never backed down from anyone. Yeah, he was a good man.
And he was small in stature.
Yeah.
And so was Governor Nutter.
You know, I never noticed that about Nutter.
Weren't they both relatively small?
He could have been, but he projected, his attitude. He was a.
But they were both pretty decisive and.
Yes.
Pretty much in charge, huh? And you'd characterize Schwinnen the same way?
Oh, yeah. Anderson was Schwinnen's role model. He tells you that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
And then, and Anderson had hired Schwinnen to be a member of his cabinet as director of the Department of State Lands. So Schwinnen had an opportunity to watch him.
You bet.
Watch him up close. And then, but you haven't described Babcock or Judge in the same way. You haven't described them as maybe was their leadership style different? Aronson, you didn't really describe that way either.
Well, he had Leslie Castles. You remember Leslie Castles?
Wesley Castles.
Wesley.
Yeah.
He ended up on the court, I think.
Yeah.
He had a great deal of influence on the Dugal.
So Wes Castles was Governor Aronson's one of his top.
Yeah, I mean,
men.
I'd go. Yeah. We'd go up to talk to him, and he'd say, "See, Wes." Hugo was a good PR man. They liked him, the Galloping Swede, and he was like people wanted their people to be. You know.
But you mentioned that he said that it was important to surround yourself with competent people.
Yes.
And that kind of advice might not have come out of Nutter or Anderson or Schwinnen. I mean, maybe they believed in surrounding themselves with good people, but they would have maybe placed a greater emphasis on being in charge themselves.
I wouldn't say that. I haven't thought about that, Bob. I wouldn't. They were strong men. They didn't need that. Tom, for an example, he was
great Tom Judge
to putting studying things and thinking about it. And Swinton already had the answer. He spit it right out. He was a very high IQ. Did you know he was in a unit in the military? They come out and they picked out these very smart people and put them in this unit all together. It was kind of an experiment to see how they'd react.
This is Governor Schwinnen during World War II?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Really? No, I didn't know
then
that.
Then he said afterwards they decided it was a bad idea because they could have got them all together in that one spot. Somebody might have killed off the whole batch of them.
Well, that's interesting. Well, boy, my impression of him, too, was that he was highly intelligent.
Yeah.
And in my meetings with him in his office, and I can remember, two or three, I don't remember that other advisors were present.
No,
he
didn't.
If I made an appointment to talk with him, heck, he could talk in detail and in depth about the Highway Department or the Department of Institutions or the Commerce Department or, you know, agricultural policy or whatever. And he was confident in being able to do so with you by himself.
He could.
And that's how I remember my conversations with him. And he'd tell you what he thought, too, pretty directly, yeah.
So he could do it, too. And they're all pretty good people. I didn't have any personal animosity towards any of them. I like Swinnen because being lieutenant governor there because, well, the Constitution provides a lieutenant governor doesn't have a damn thing to do unless the legislature gives him something to do, or the governor gives him something to do, or the governor dies, then he's got something to say, but the rest of the time he's sitting there like a spare tire. I wouldn't want that job for 4 years.
Now, what happened was George Terman, who had been Schwinnen's running mate and been his lieutenant governor, was appointed, I think, to the Northwest Power Council. And so to fill out the remainder of that term in office until Schwinnen left office, he appointed you as lieutenant governor. So you were lieutenant governor for what, a couple years?
One.
Just 1 year, the last year of the Schwinnen administration.
George was a gentleman and a scholar.
George Terman.
Yes. And I believe he had ambitions to be governor. But he wasn't an aggressive, pushing type of fellow. He had a hard time selling himself. He wanted them just to look at him and observe him. And
tall, kind of reserved, kind of intellectual.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He wasn't intellectual. And so when he, another thing that could have impacted is that Swindon decided not to run again, and he decided not to recommend anyone. And so everybody was on their own then, you see. And I think that was a factor in him appointing me, was that he knew damn well I didn't want to be lieutenant governor. So
or governor either.
I mean governor, yes, yeah. Governor.
So yeah. He was kind of, that was his way of kind of showing that he wasn't designating an heir apparent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, he was kind of proud of his appointments, and I don't think he made very many bad ones, and I didn't think he was too worried that I was going to ruin his reputation.
Did it ever occur to you to run for governor?
No. Once you get your name in the paper a few times and your friends think, boy, you'd make a good congressman or a good governor, but early in life, I decided I didn't. It wasn't my game. No, I didn't want to. I had an opportunity to run for lieutenant governor under Judge, but anyway, I was approached by a couple of people that said they were feeling me out for him. Tell you who it was. It was Elmer Flynn and
Senator Elmer Flynn, Democrat from Missoula.
Yeah. Old Elmer had emphysema or something so bad he could smoke as many cigarettes. I thought he was going to succumb right there on the floor. He'd lose his breath. But anyway, I said, no thanks. I'm not interested. So we got Joe Roberts.
Yeah.
I've got a book here you and Joe gave me, you know, on the forest detail
the
you were on.
Western
with?
States Legislative Forestry Task Force.
Yeah.
You bet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I served in the both the House and Senate with Joe. He was a representative and a senator from Lincoln County, Democrat.
I could have hung him. He was he was party whip on my side of the aisle. He gets up and makes a motion to adjourn sine die.
Do you remember what the issue was?
Well, he just wanted to go home. It was the last night of the last session.
Oh, and he wanted to beat the majority leader to the motion?
I guess so.
Generally, the majority leader, of course, would make that motion.
Yeah.
But you weren't quite ready for it?
No. Well, that Paul Boylan made the motion, too, that night, that last night of that last 70.
Now, Paul Boylan was a very, very independent-minded Democrat senator from Bozeman.
Boy, he wanted to be president.
He wanted to be president of the Senate?
And he kept asking me, you're going to run, and I'm playing it coy. I got to think. And so he finally decided that I told him that I wasn't going to run again. But you know, that when we were evenly divided that time, 25 on each side.
In 1977.
Was that it?
Yep.
The last one. Well, he offered to switch sides and vote on the Republican side. Matt Himsel said if he did, he'd vote on our side.
Yeah.
So that took care of that.
Yeah.
You just visited with Matt, have you?
Had a great visit with Matt, a great interview with Matt.
He's a fine man. I always respected him. Good man. Is he still holding up all right?
Still nearly 90 years old, and he's in mint condition. I mean, his speech is affected a little bit because his teeth don't fit very well. and his hearing is, you've got to speak up to him a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with his mind, and he reads a lot, and he remembers well, and he's a pretty remarkable guy.
He was. I always respected him. He was a good man. I was going through some things here last week, and I come across some letters, and it had a folder, and in there was several pages of propositions. First, the Democrats. We had that tie, you know. And the Democrats had propositioned the Republicans, and they come back with the Republicans. So we finally got together on it, and Bill Mathers and I issued a press release, and we didn't write, but Anyway, there's that whole.
Now, Bill Mathers was the Republican leader in the 1977 session.
He wasn't there then, but he was involved in it. He and Turnage and Hazelbaker were the senators.
Frank Hazelbaker from Dillon.
Yeah. So anyway, Bill's name's on this, and Turnage's name is on it.
And it was the agreement. There had to be some kind of a...
Yes, how we divide up the committee chairmanships.
Yeah.
Some got vice chairman and some got chairman, and we sat down and worked it all out.
Well, you know, Gordon, that document is... it's been revised a little bit, I think, but I think that what you folks negotiated during that 1977 session in the Senate has been used as the model since then, both in the Senate and in the House, when the legislature's been tied since then, as it was, I believe, that... I believe the House was in 1985, and I think the Senate might have been maybe in 87 or something, and then
the Constitution, I believe, called for the in case of a tie, the party of the governor would have the right to elect either the president or the speaker.
But the question, I think, beyond that was whether that carried with it the entire organization of the body or just the presiding officer. And what you guys negotiated was that it meant the presiding officer. But that you then split the loaf down the middle with the rest of it, and the Republicans and Democrats chose which committees they'd have chairmanships of. But what was done as fairly and equally as possible.
You know what I think? I think they were looking for a one House legislature, and they assumed that the Speaker would in the House. The Speaker appoints all the officers.
Yes.
And they were assuming that's the way it was going to work.
Yeah.
But in the Senate...
You're talking about the Constitutional Convention delegates who wrote the 1972 Constitution.
Yeah.
Assumed that when that was ratified, the people had to vote whether or not to ratify the Constitution in 1972. And then there were three side issues on the ballot, one dealing with capital punishment, one dealing with legalized gambling, and one dealing with the unicameral legislature. And so what you're saying is that there was perhaps the feeling there that the unicameral legislature would pass, and that the concept we're talking about would have made more sense then, perhaps.
Yes, because the Senate has a committee on what are the committees? No,
Senate's got a committee on committees.
It appoints the committees. The president doesn't like
That's
the speaker.
Right. The Speaker of the House appoints all the committees.
Yes, he's all powerful.
All powerful, but on the Senate side, the president of the Senate does not do that.
No, it's entirely different operation in the. But anyway, we sit down and worked it out all right, and it worked good. And one state, I think, could have been Illinois, were still fighting over their tie when we were through and went home.
Yeah. Well, I remember, in fact, too, that I was in the legislature, I think, twice when the body was tied, and I don't remember those as being particularly bad sessions.
Oh, yeah.
Because they force cooperation. You know, there has to be some bipartisan.
Well, we knew if we bowled ahead. It takes more than a majority to pass a bill, so they were still the other side, regardless of which party's on the saddle, is in control. They have a veto power, so you just as well get together.
It makes sense.
Now,
you know, we talk about the new Constitution, and you are one of the relatively few people who served both extensively before the 1972 Constitution and then after the 1972 Constitution. And, you know, do you have any thoughts on how the 72 Constitution may have, what changes it may have brought in our legislature and the politics of our state?
Yes, I do. You know, I supported that because it was very apparent the procedures needed changing. For an example, that old thing of reading the bills. We were there when they had four clerks reading the...
Yeah, yeah. The old 1889 Constitution required that the bills be read at length. Three times.
Yeah.
And I think that was a throwback to the era when not everyone could read and write.
Right.
Who was a legislator. And so for everyone to understand, they'd read the bill at length, the entire bill, from the rostrum, and then assign it to a committee. And everybody got to hear the bill, so if it sounded like it was an egg bill, it shouldn't have gone to the health committee. Everybody knew it because they all heard it read. And then when it came back and was debated on the floor, and what we call second reading, it was read from the rostrum at length again. And then when it was voted on a final time, a third time, it was called third reading, it was read at length a third time. And so what you and I both remember was that very early in my career and late in yours, we'd have two or three fellows standing up at the rostrum all just chattering gibberish, just reading as fast as they
sentences.
Could. You know, reading every third sentence or whatever they could, as fast as they could, to go through the fiction of pretending like they were reading these bills at length. And so the 1972 Constitution dispensed with that nonsense and made it unnecessary to do that.
That's the sort of thing I was thinking about when the procedure needed changing. And the other one was that 60-day limit. Were you there when we used to pull the plug on the clock?
Yes.
And or hang a towel over it and go through that farce of... and then we never got paid either.
The 1889 Constitution required that the legislature could meet for 60 calendar days.
Mm-hmm.
That included Saturdays and Sundays and everything. So if the people's business didn't get done at the end of 60 days, and it frequently didn't, then we'd cover the clock in the House chamber and in the Senate chamber, and that would be pretended like the last day might have lasted for a week, whatever it took for the business to get finished. And as you mentioned, the legislators didn't get paid during that period of time. And so if you were a poor guy, it put undue hardship on you. Some guys didn't care. They could stall forever for their point of view. But if a guy was in a bind financially, he about had to agree to something. And so the unfairness of that was a pretty obvious thing.
Yeah.
And how did the 72 Constitution help that?
Well, they extended it to an annual session. I think now it can go to... 90 days, and if they want, with the approval of both houses, you can extend it. You know, we got in that.
And this stop the clock business has never occurred since then.
You know, we stretched things a little on that last night on.
Yeah.
On. But anyway, another thing that I didn't care for was this opening up the committee meetings or publishing the vote on second reading. You know, the legislature is a deliberative body like the court. And under the old system, people come in and gave their opinion, you listened to the debate and everything, then you shut the door and worked it over and come together and made a decision, and nobody bugged you. But now when they opened up second reading...
You're talking really about the committee deliberations, aren't you?
Yeah. And it goes for its committee of the whole, too.
Yeah.
When they started recording or opening up the committee hearings, then the people from eastern Montana had gone home, but the lobbyists were still there, and they could come in and guess or test who was doing on which side, and go and round up a batch of people to come in and lobby us some more. But you used to have that. You took care of it, and it was done with, and you weren't subjected to all that pressure afterwards. And I felt it didn't give everyone a fair chance when they got away from that. When they started to record the votes and open up those committee meetings, I just didn't think that was right.
Huh. You don't think it was maybe fair if the committee meetings were completely open?
No, because the poor people or the working people had to go home, and the other guys were hanging around there to pressure you some more. I was in there, and one bill I remember, and I expressed a little opinion on it. When we were what we used to do after second reading, you wouldn't make a decision that day. You'd make a decision later on and do your discussion later on.
Yeah.
Well, we're in this discussion later on, a couple of days later, and a lobbyist heard me make a remark. And when I got out, there were 7 phone calls waiting for me. The other side didn't get that chance.
They didn't get that chance.
But we got that open meeting law, and it's going to stay.
Now,
I didn't like... I like the democratic process where it goes through both houses, all those hearings. And on each bill, the final vote on each bill is on a separate bill. But you know how that Constitution works. It was like they went through second reading on everything and threw them all in the pot, and you voted take it all or leave it all.
That's right. You know, another provision of the Constitution that's not procedural in terms of the legislature is one that gives us the constitutional right in the state to a clean and healthful environment.
Yes.
Any thoughts on that? Because I think that's unique. I don't think any other state in the nation has.
Well, have they defined what it is?
Well.
I see in the paper today the Supreme Court still hasn't decided
education. Yeah.
And the legislature bucked it to the Supreme Court. This morning, the Supreme Court in the paper has bucked it back to the legislature. After 32 years, they can't define one word, and it's the same thing on that environment.
Yeah.
I think if that had gone through the regular process and then there'd been a period afterwards to really study that, maybe it would have come out different.
Gordon, we've just got a couple of minutes left on our tape here, and so now might be an opportunity for you, if I haven't asked a question that you wish I would have asked, or if there's a point you want to emphasize a little more, or something you want to say in closing or in summary or anything, now would be the time to do it.
I think we've pretty well covered this. I'm not running for anything, so there's no point in campaigning anymore. I really enjoyed being a legislator. I think it's quite an honor, and some really, really fine people, and I think sometimes maybe I've made a little impact on government, but met a lot of fine people, great people, great people.
Well, it's been a pleasure having this visit with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.